Hi there, I'm Corey Rabin, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcasts, where we inspire recovery from addiction and try to discover a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substances or are already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery, alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories on your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up and let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and we have a really exciting episode today. I'm thrilled and honored to have the person at the top of the food chain at one of the most preeminent recovery centers in the United States, a charitable organization that does amazing work, the Karen Treatment Center. And I am an alumni of the Karen Treatment Center. I'm standing here sober talking to you because of the people at Karen. And I want to remind you, by the way, since you're getting a really very valuable show today, to like, subscribe, hit the bell, and tell us what we're doing good, tell us what we're doing bad, and we'll listen to what you have to say and respond to your comments. But without further ado, I want to welcome my friend John Driscoll to Crosstalk. Welcome, John.
Well, thank you. Great to be here, Corey. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. It's really an honor to be sitting here with you. We've had a lot of wonderful people sitting in that chair. No one more well-versed, educated, and informed on addiction and recovery and treatment for addiction and recovery than you. And let's talk a little bit about where you're from. If I remember correctly, I did a little homework, and there's a place called the Upper Peninsula.
Yes,
the UP.
Correct.
What the hell is that?
That's the UP. Upers is what we call ourselves. We are a result of the Toledo War, actually, between Michigan and Ohio. Back when Ohio was a state, Michigan was a territory. They got into a fight over Toledo, and Michigan lost. And as a consolation, they got the UP when they became a state, which is, most people think it's part of Wisconsin, but it's the upper part. It's what we call God's country, about 300,000 people in a vast wilderness. And that's where I was born and raised, went to college.
Very good. And there are lakes over there, right?
There's a lot of lakes there. The Great Lakes, we touch three of them at least, Michigan, Superior, and Huron. And they are quite cold and deep.
Do you fish on the lakes?
Well, absolutely. A lot of people fish on the lakes. I grew up about an hour south of that, right in the central Upper Peninsula, about 120 miles straight north of Green Bay, Wisconsin. Is where I was. So I didn't do a lot of fishing in the big lakes. I fished in local lakes and around in the rural community. I did go to college at Northern Michigan University, which is right off of Lake Superior. And let me tell you, in December and January, you can get 35, 40 below zero, and wind chills coming off that lake. It's something to write home about. I it was so cold one year, the car handle actually broke off in my hand.
Oh my God.
As I tried to open the door, it just snapped due to the cold.
You've spent time in other cities that are really cold. So
yes.
Was that the coldest? Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Marquette, Michigan, some of the very coldest weather around. I 50 years I've spent in the Midwest. So northern Wisconsin, Minnesota, and now my daughter is actually in Fargo, North Dakota, because I guess Wisconsin wasn't cold enough for her.
Got it. So you grew up, mom and dad, were they professionals, or what did they do?
Working class family, grew up, mom and dad. They met at a small community dance. My dad was a Marine, came back from Korea, met my mom, who was a nurse. My dad ended up working with his brother-in-law on the Milwaukee Road. It's a railroad. He was an engineer who drove the train. And One of my earliest memories was 5 years old. My dad actually stopped the train. I got on at the crossing next to my grandma's, and I got to drive the train the 10 miles into the roundhouse. So that's what they did. It was a great small town atmosphere, very rural, and couldn't imagine a better upbringing.
That's great. That's great. Now, you had an aunt that impacted you a lot. She gave you advice. Was that your mom's sister?
No, it's actually my dad's sister.
Okay.
Sister Connie. She was an interesting character. There was actually an article written in the local, because at the time, my grandparents were living in Sault Ste. Marie, Canada. And my dad and his older brother, Jerome, had joined the Marines. And their sister, Connie, had joined the Women's Army Corps and served in the military. Connie was a real fascinating character. And over her time, she lived in a lot of different places, did a lot of different jobs. And 1 year she went back to visit the nuns that had taught her as a little girl. And next thing you know, she became a missionary sister of the poor. And together with another nun, Sister Teresa O'Sullivan, started a homeless shelter that I eventually ended up working at and started into the addiction business.
That's where you kind of caught the buzz, so to speak. That's probably not the best expression.
That's right. That's where I caught the buzz. It was actually at my dad's funeral. My dad died young in life at about 55. I was going into my junior year of college. I was going to be in psychology. I thought I was going to be a psychologist, and I had only been up in the UP, in the Upper Peninsula. And my aunt at the funeral said, "John, you got to get out of here. Or you're going to be here forever." She said, "Why don't you come to Chicago? We'll create an internship for you." So they had been operating for about 8 years already. And they had a unique approach. They did not accept any city, state, or federal funding whatsoever. It was only run by private donations. So they got to sort of call the shots as to what they did. And as nuns, they had a little bit of the tough love. They believed in accountability and responsibility. And their job was to help folks move from homelessness to, you know, getting a job, raising their family, and returning to normal life. When I got there on the scene, though, it was in the middle of a huge crack cocaine epidemic.
It was like the 90s?
It was late 80s, early 90s in Chicago, 64th and Woodlawn, gang-ridden. It was one of the communities identified to be regentrified at the time. And what we found is that we would help the women, because nearly all of them were on public assistance. So because they were staying at the shelter and we were provided room and board and, you know, the food to go with it, that's the board side of it, we required them to save 80% of their public aid check and 90% of their food stamps. So after 3 to 4 months, they had a sum of money that could be first and last month's rent. They had the ability to get a start into an apartment. They had food stamps ready to go. And boom, we've addressed the homelessness issue. And it was really, really well accepted. There was one small caveat, though.
I think I know. There's a little bit too much money in their pocket.
Turns out having $3,000 to $4,000 in your pocket all of a sudden and a raging crack cocaine problem does not bode well for a recipe for success. And so the next month, they were back homeless and broke again because it was all gone. And so it was there, actually, with the help of a recovering priest by the name of Father Gordon. Okay. Interesting scenario. And then a brother, Marco, who was a counselor there, the three of us sort of got together and said, we've got to address that in some way. And Father Gordon would run a couple of AA groups in the basement couple times a week. Some of the women would go, and the homeless shelter was mainly for women and children. And I would refer to them as functionally homeless, in the sense that these were not people who were chronically mentally ill. These were people that, due to drug abuse, due to domestic abuse due to poverty, lack of jobs, those types of things, were suddenly unhoused and needed housing.
Not a lot of education.
Not a lot of education. Chicago public school systems weren't a great educator of individuals. It was a rough go at it. And so it was there that we really tried to say we need to put more structure. And so we created a 6-month long, which ended up being as long as 14 month long, long-term recovery program, really utilizing the NA basic text. Because in the South Side, that was used a little bit more in the neighborhoods where there were more of those meetings around. And the text was frankly more simply written than the big book. So when you're dealing with a population that didn't have a great reading ability, didn't have great reading comprehension, this book spoke to them a little bit better. So I really became an expert in NA. And then over the course of 8 years, I created this program that did everything from, loose detox to residential care to ongoing care to people working in the community, coming back, volunteering. As a matter of fact, I still stay in contact with some of the women that now have over 35 years sober. From when they started in that program, it's just been absolutely amazing part of my life.
Now, you spent 8 years doing that.
8 years. I lived at the center too.
What'd you like about it?
What did I like about it? Good golly. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. I was in my 20s. I was single. And in college, I thought I wanted to be a business major. And when I got into it, I didn't like it. It didn't hit my heartstrings. What got me going was the ability to help people. I noticed early on, I had an ability to read people's buttons, which can be used for good, could be used for evil too. But I thought, let me try to help people understand that they're in control of their emotions. Don't let somebody like me push their buttons. Let me show you how to control these so that you can move in your right direction. And it was there that I said, I want to try to help people. And so I was at the funeral that my aunt said, well, come down and help them. So I went in, naive 20-year-old, thinking, what can I do to help homeless people feel better about being homeless? And I stumbled into the addiction. And what I saw there, the transformation that I saw, you need to understand this, is that these women that were addicted to crack cocaine at the time, we were in an old, abandoned Catholic school, St. Clara's School, built in like 1903. We bought it from the Archdiocese for $1, completely rehabbed it, fixed it up. The women there, I used to talk with them, they used to be walking the back alleys, doing what they needed to do for a $5 or $10 bag of crack cocaine. And I used to talk to them in the first entrance and say, life's getting better, because before you used to be in the alley behind the shelter. Now you're actually in a bed in the shelter. And what I was able to experience there, and that's what made me fall in love with working a 12-step program, is these women found real recovery. They became productive, responsible members of society. They became parents and mothers again. Many of them had lost custody of their children through DCFS in the system, through their drinking and drugging. One of the things I'm most proud about in my entire life and career is that I, through my course and working with them, I learned I needed to go help them in court. Because in court, and you're a lawyer, you know this, there's a state's attorney, there's an guardian ad litem, which is the child's attorney, and then there's generally just a public defender, and you're just a caseload on there. And so I knew these women were working hard. They had put together 6-8 months of treatment, and they would go to court and just come back devastated. And so I started to go with them. And over that course in time, I started to become an expert. I started to get known by the juvenile court judges in Chicago. And I got 63 children returned to their parents, sometimes under my supervision at the shelter, but other times ended up with theirs. And to this date, none of them ended up back in the system again. The moms worked real life recovery programs. It's amazing today how in this business, people stay in the business, get in there. So one of these women, I'm Facebook friends with several of them. And I remember when she came in, she was on the top bunk. She was probably 6 months pregnant. Little tiny thing would climb up onto the top bunk. Well, her son today works as a cameraman for an ABC affiliate in Atlanta and just got married and has his own children. And to me, I can't imagine doing a better job than the job I get to do, where I get to see miracles happen. I get to be present for really the birth of hope. When you see somebody come in, and you know what this is, when you see somebody at powerlessness, powerlessness isn't a word. It's a feeling. It's an emotion. It's completely raw terror. And you begin to see hope begin to develop, that this isn't how life has to be, that things can improve. And then you get to play the tape forward. It's absolutely amazing.
Can you imagine this? I often, over the 40 or so years, 42 years that I've been in the world of recovery, took a little couple of year break there in the middle, but the amount of the people that stick in my head are the people that didn't make it, the ones that I tried and it didn't work. And for some reason, it must be some kind of psychological thing that people have where the trauma stuff is harder to go away. But when you talk about the people that, you know, the story about this Atlanta cameraman who's got a good job and a family now, can you imagine all the people you've helped that you have no idea how you've impacted their lives? The world of people that you've impacted with the work that you've done, we've talked a little bit about it, we'll get more into it. That's really exciting to think of, just how one person can do so much for so many. Yeah. It's a pretty exciting thing just to consider, even though we never know what the limits of that is. It's pretty big. And it reminds me of the mustard seed. You know,
absolutely.
You know, you don't know. There's one of our, I say our, I'm not, our competitors, so to speak, has this thing called a 2-degree shift, a little change. If you take a plane and you leave it at LA destined for New York, and if you change the flight plan by 2 degrees, you end up in Philadelphia. A small change can make incredible impacts. And you've made some, you're talking to us a little bit about it. And the anecdotes of these stories are so exciting. I can see why you love what you do.
Absolutely. It's the greatest feeling ever. And, you know, the old saying, if you love your job, you never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
I've been in the industry now for 34, going on 35 years. I absolutely love it. I get energized by what we do. But again, as you started off, you do still remember those that you lost. I talk about, I got 63 children returned to their parents. I know I at least took 3 away from their parents. I had a woman come in. She already had custody of her children. And she was just really jonesing on heroin. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. The gates had been closed. And she had called her dealer. And she was planning on leaving. And she had her 3 little kids in tow, probably like 4, 3, and 1, or very, very young. I know 2 of them were still in diapers. And I didn't really have any real authority at the time. I was just a civilian. She was just living there. And I said, you can't go with those kids. She's like, I can. They're my children. I'm like, you cannot go with those children. And after about 10 minutes of arguing with her, she just said, well, you take them. I'm leaving. And she slammed out the door, hopped the fence, got in the car, and I never saw her again. And the next morning then, because the rest of the women, we took care of the kids overnight, we called DCFS, and they came and got them. That's a memory that sticks in my mind, as to wonder whatever happened to those 3 little kids, wonder whatever happened to mom.
Yeah, it's certainly not, you know, that's all part of it. It's part we try to avoid by our efforts, but you know, the good I think certainly outweighs the bad, although you know, the chances for people to recover from this awful disease, you know, the majority of people don't ever see the doors of the Care and Treatment Center or even AA and successfully, you know, live that way, but a lot do. that's the ones we're working for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I will say one of the biggest blessings of my career in life is a result of the pandemic. So these women that I worked with in Chicago, they're a strong network. They still stick together. And there was a group of them there from the early 90s that sponsor a lot of people. They're still involved with the program there in Chicago. And they get together every month for a dinner. And the pandemic hit. They couldn't get together in person anymore. So they started to get together on Zoom. And I talked to one of the leaders. Her name's Juanita. I talk about her all the time and her two daughters. And Juanita called me and said, John, we've got this Zoom meeting. Wouldn't it be great if you joined us and surprised them? I said, that sounds fabulous. And so what I got to do was time travel. You know how we always talk about play the tape forward? I got to play the tape forward 30 years, 25 at least, where how did the, what's the rest of the story? Remember Paul Harvey's?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
rest of the story?
Mm-hmm.
I got to experience that because suddenly I was on this Zoom call with about a dozen women I had worked with in the early 90s, and here it was 2020.
It's a blessing.
And I got to hear them say, and they went around the room, I got 31 sober. I got 25 sober. I've got 20 sober. And I remember this one gal, Trina, she started to cry a little bit. And Trina was, she was a character. She was such a character when she was with us. She's like, oh, John, I'm sorry. She went through the tears. She's like, I went back out. She's like, I only have 14 years sober now. I'm like, can you imagine that? 14 years sober. The fact she's still alive after all this was just absolutely amazing. And I got to hear the update of their kids. One of the gals, when she was with us in the shelter, her adult son was in the gangs, got caught up gangbanging and killed a person. And I remember she came to me. She's like, John, can you help? Can you think maybe Sister Connie could help him get work release? And I'm like, it's murder. I don't think they're going to give him work release. He got sentenced to 20 years. He was out of prison now because this had been over 25 years. And I got to hear his story and what happened to them. And these kids, I used to, because we had all these cribs around, and I would go around during the day and I'd be like, these are not little jail cells. And I'd pick them up. You need to watch your children. And I'd set them free. These are for sleeping. And all these little kids that are 2, 3, 4 years old that I formed all these cute little bonds with, they're now grown. They're adults. They have lives. They have children of their own. I got to see the rest of the story. It's easily going to be in the top 5 of the greatest moments of my career and, frankly, my life personally, to be able to see what's happened to somebody that's lived a life of recovery.
You know, you ever hear of a book called A Course in Miracles?
I don't know if I've heard of that one.
I think I might give you a gift before you leave today. It's a really wonderful book that a lady in AA named Vivian G, who passed away this year, if you can have a girl sponsor, I don't think you can say a girl sponsor, but I think there's something wrong with saying the word girl, but she was somebody I adored and loved greatly. And she sent me a text message. She passed away in March. And I was looking at our text messages recently, and it reminded me of what you're saying. You remind me of what she was saying. And what she was saying, it was course number 61 in A Course in Miracles, lesson number 61 in A Course in Miracles. It's about being the light for other people. Our lives, just being a place where we can bring the light to other people. That's what came to me when you were talking. And it's so beautiful to be able to see the product of that. But you went to Minnesota after Chicago, right?
I did.
Why did you go to Minnesota?
Well, by accident. So I met my wife at the shelter. No, she was not a resident. she came down to volunteer. And I was living with nuns at the shelter. She was living with priests. On a 1-year Capuchin volunteer piece. And she didn't like the placement she had. And so the priest, Father Brian, I believe his name, talked with Sister Therese. And Sister Therese was always looking to make sure I could find a gal and get married and live a good life. She thought I would make a good husband for somebody. And they offered her a chance to volunteer, and she was happened to be from Minnesota. And growing up in the UP, Minnesota was always a great place, I thought. It had the ruralness, but it also had Minneapolis, which was a big city and easy to get around in. It wasn't overly populated. And I always thought Minnesota would be okay. And then all of a sudden here, God puts this woman from Oakdale, Minnesota into my life. And she finishes out her volunteer piece. I talk her into staying. She stays with us together. We're a year and a half. We decided to get married and like, okay, we don't want to live in the inner city. We don't want to raise our kids in the inner city. Let's go back to Minnesota. So I had used Hazelden publishing materials. Many of us do out there. A lot of great recovery books. And I had written the book. Did your research find the book?
I have everything on my notes.
Okay. And so I thought, I'm going to get this published. So I went onto their website in like 1997. There was only two things there, the counselor training program and publishing. So I wrote up the manuscript, sent them my book because they were going to publish me and I was going to be a great author. This was going to be wonderful. And they sent it back and said, thanks, we're going another direction. We're not publishing these books anymore. And so I like, well, I applied to the counselor training program anyways, because I was going to Minnesota. I need to be licensed. I need to have all these things. All right, let me do that. So I, after getting turned down from multiple jobs, working at homeless shelters and other treatment programs for women in Minnesota, I reluctantly became a counselor trainee at Hazelden, and loved it. They loved my experience. And then I started to apply for jobs, and then they didn't hire me. I got turned down three different times for jobs at Hazelden.
Wow.
Before they finally agreed to hire me as a part-time on-call counselor for $13 an hour, no benefits. I said, yes, I will take it. And that was the start of my professional career at Hazelden.
You know, Bowtie was sitting in the seat you're sitting in a few hours ago, and it's very similar. It was knocking on doors. Doors weren't opening. And but, you know, the story that follows is a story of, you know, apart from your resilience and continuing to knock on the doors of great success. So you started as a part-time counselor at Hazelden.
Yes, that was the second chapter of my career. After 8 years in Chicago, sort of doing my own thing, I joined a big organization after multiple times getting shot down. I thought a lot of myself back then. I applied for big positions. The position I got was on-call counselor.
And how many years were you there before you became King Shit? I think I said that wrong.
That's a technical term. So I in the first 2.5 years, I moved jobs quickly. I started as an on-call counselor. I got hired full-time. I became a senior counselor. I went into training. And actually, I'd travel here to New York and train at their New York office. There's another story for another podcast about how I was supposed to be here on 9/11, but ended up having that canceled. But that's for another podcast. And so in 2001, I became one of the youngest executive directors of the Center City campus, where I oversaw Hazelden's main campus.
That was the main campus
in Center City at the age of 31. And I did that for 5 years. And then I became the clinical director for 5 years at 31. And then at 36, I became the executive director of Center City and did that for a few years. And then they got their new CEO at the time, Mark Mishick. And from there, I became on his executive team. And then over the course of about 5 years, I started accumulating Hazelden sites and roles where I would oversee the Midwest and then the East Coast as well as the Midwest and then the front end and then the Northwest. And then in 2015, they said with the merger with the Betty Ford Center.
And you did, you handled the merger, right?
All over it. I am not responsible for the merger. I like to say I may be responsible for making it successful, though, because I was in the clinical operations to help the transformation occur. Great organizations on both sides taught me a lot, invested a lot in their employees. You know, with Hazelden's benefits, I went back to school, got an MBA, did much training, a lot of leadership, management development, did a lot of coaching. I received a lot of coaching. They invested in me, and the goal was for me to be a viable candidate to be the next CEO of Hazel and Betty Ford when Mark Mishick retired. And as most things in my life, God had other plans, and I didn't get the job. And it was a little amazing. It was a little strange to me, like, wow, I hadn't applied for a job for 15 years. I just kept getting promoted. And suddenly, nope, you're not going to be the CEO. I stayed for a year under their new CEO, Dr. Joe Lee, a wonderful child psychiatrist. Joe had worked for me for many years over at our Plymouth location. And the board said, you know, this is what we're looking for. This is what we want to do. And so I worked with Joe for a while and gave it a full year, and then decided, you know what, there's a different path. I don't know what it is. And I retired. I started a small consulting business. That was just to give me something to do. It wasn't big. I worked for a few of my friends through the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. Actually worked for Brad Sorte here at Caron. Worked with the co-CEOs at Ashley Treatment Centers, and did some work with Dave Gomel out of Rosecrans. 10 hours a week, 15, 20 hours a week at most at times, and was just helping my friends run their business.
You were also the NAATP.
Yeah. So I joined there.
Why don't you tell everybody what it stands for?
NAATP is the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. It's basically the trade organization for the industry. You know, it has over 1,000 treatment centers that belong to it. And Hazel and Betty Ford, just like Caron, have members on their board of trustees. And so I ended up going on to the board when I was with Hazelden, as I had a senior leader position, and worked my way up through the ranks there, did my time, was overseeing conference committees and treasurer and vice chair. And then I spent a couple of years as chairman during the pandemic, because I didn't want to make it an easy chairmanship. I wanted to make sure it was something that was tearing everything up. I remember I was talking with Marv Ventrell, the CEO, it was been March of 2020, because we always have our annual conference in May. And we were on the phone, and I was working from home, and we were talking, what are we going to do about this conference? You know, it's only supposed to last 2 more weeks, right? It's going to be over. This is almost done. The pandemic's over. And I was watching TV, and I'm like, Marv, they just canceled the NBA season. It had just broke. And I'm like, I think we're done. I think we got to cancel the conference. That 2020 was a crazy time.
It sure was. It sure was. I was at a Graham Nash concert on March 8th. Was the last public thing that was held in the Westchester, New York City area, and everything just got canceled. Broadway got canceled in New York. I think, you know, during the pandemic, I was in Florida, and I would look down at Ocean Drive outside of my building. Once in a while, you'd see somebody riding a bike.
Yeah.
But that's it. Nobody on the beach. Beaches were closed. It was a really crazy time. And to navigate through the service of people going to treatment in that kind of an environment, especially with family programs, and the whole idea is to connect. Connecting is so important it's one of the most important things that you can do to try to arrest this terrible disease. And, you know, the pandemic had other ideas.
It really did. It was difficult on staff. It was difficult on patients. It was difficult on the whole country's psyche of what does all this mean? What's going to happen? There was real fear in the beginning in some people's eyes, and in others, it's just another day. It was such a strange time frame to live through and to work through.
And one of the things that, you know, there are always unexpected benefits that you find from bad things. Sometimes come great lessons or some great things. I remember being in my home group meeting, And a lady came to a meeting. She was so nervous. She had never been to a meeting. She was only on Zoom meetings. And she thought it was such a wonderful thing, but she was frightened because she had only seen people on screens. There were a lot of people actually were able to get it together with the virtual format, you know.
Well, I'll give you my example of God smiles and has different timing. So for 2 years, we did the research, we did the studies, we did the pilot groups. We worked with the insurance companies to start up something called virtual care, virtual IOP groups. We started it in 2018. We had done pilot groups, we had done studies. We got it to work, and finally, we're going live. We got the regulators to sign off on it. We're launching this thing March 20th, 2020. And the world turned upside down on March 13th. And we were there. We were Blue Ocean. Nobody else was really going into this market. No other treatment center was thinking about it. All the stuff we had to do with CFR 42, which is the special privacy regulations. Most of these Zoom and stuff, they weren't compliant. You couldn't use them. We had to use all this different stuff. And then suddenly overnight, everybody's in the virtual market. Talk about bad timing. We had done all this work to get ahead of people and be the first ones in. And literally overnight, everybody's in virtual care. And it's still around today. That was a crazy time for the work we put in.
Interesting thing. You know, those examples are in all different disciplines. My daughter was working at an agency in New York representing comedians.
Okay.
And had started a podcast division about 2019. And by 2020, she had this thing up and running. And when COVID hit, every agent in the entire company wanted their talent to go on the podcast because there was no place else to go. There are these unintended God winks that you get that you never know. There are going to be some benefits that we find out of things that we really are unhappy about. That happens.
You know, I always say if I write another book, the title will be More Will Be Revealed. Because I've had those God winks. I like your terminology you just used there. Throughout my life going back in time. You know, one of the things that people say about me is my resiliency, my positive attitude towards things. And I can go back. This is one of these More Will Be Revealed events that happened in my life that at the time didn't know why, didn't necessarily want them to happen that way, but did and turned out to be great for me. One of the first ones I remember, I was in kindergarten, half day kindergarten, 5 years old. Remember the old TV show Emergency about the two paramedics at LA Rampart? And I had brought my little red fireman's hat to show and tell that day. And my grandmother lived just a mile down the street from me. And this is out in the woods. And the school bus dropped me off at home and I was supposed to get off at grandma's. And I get up to the front door and it's locked. And there's a little bit of drizzle. It was a day like today, 50 degrees, little rain drizzle out there. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And I put the hat on and I walked the mile down the highway to my grandma's. And I remember, you know, I could have sat there and cried, let somebody come and get me. I could have, you know, got lost in the woods. But I'm like, I've got to figure out how to do this. And here's the resources I got. And I remember because the bus used to have to turn around and go back. And the bus driver, Stuart, was coming back and I could see him and I'm on the road now. So I wave at him. He just waves back. That was the 70s. That's what we did back then. Just wave back, kept going. And it took me about 20 minutes to walk to my elder grandma's house. But I got there. And as I walked through the door, she's like, oh, there you are. I was just about to send your uncle out looking for you. Like, I'm here. And we just moved on like it was no big deal. But that memory sticks. And there's so many of those life experiences to me that had this gone a little bit differently in my life, even with my father's death, had my dad not died, and I didn't want him to die. He died at 55. He was a great dad. He was really involved. I loved everything about him. Today I'd trade the world to have him back. But as a result of him dying is why I had the conversation with my aunt at his funeral and ended up in Chicago And that's why I'm sitting here today. So when I talk about more will be revealed, and you mentioned a little bit about those 2-degree shifts in turn, I can trace that back 50 years in my life is to the little winks, the little nudges that send you off course, but end up being such a pivotal part of what your life is. It's one of the things that brings hope and optimism to me in any situation. And it all starts with a simple lesson of gratitude. Be grateful for today. And that's really a big piece of the program and the 12 steps that are out there. If you can start the day off with an attitude of gratitude, it just makes everything better.
If I mentioned the singer's name at tonight's dinner, everybody's going to boo.
Okay.
But the guy's name is Jason Mraz.
Okay.
And he sings some really inspiring songs. And if you allow me to bore you, I'll do that another time. But he sings a song called I'm Yours. And in the song, he says, I reckon it's time to win some or learn some. And the stuff that seems like we're losing are opportunities to grow. And that's what you're describing. And that's what I've experienced in my own life. Things don't go well. Something comes from it that's going to provide us with some kind of guidance, some kind of opportunity. And, you know, I think part of the ability to stay sober is to look at things that don't go the way you want it. Instead of trying to change everything around you, you kind of roll with it and get something from it.
Exactly. The ability to lean into it. And you know, that's the healing powers of step 2 and 3. I talked about powerlessness being this freak out, oh my goodness. But then, and you also mentioned the mustard seed. That's all you need is that kernel of belief that something somewhere other than you can begin to restore you to sanity. And then making that decision, that choice. I talked about turning your will in your life. Well, what's your will? It's what you want. What's your life? It's what you do. Turning what you want and what you do over to the care of this higher power doesn't mean it's going to go your way. Doesn't mean you get to be the director and the writer of the script. It just means that you get the opportunity to ride that script out and see what the experience is. And there will be days of tragedy and terror and sadness, but it's out of those will also be born days of happiness and gratitude.
Yep.
And peacefulness. And, you know, the sayings in the program, stick around for the miracle to happen. Keep taking a breath. I used to talk to folks, you know, in the mental health field and stuff, sometimes the suicidality, you know, that permanent solution to a temporary problem. Sometimes it's like, you know what, let's get a good nap in here. Let's see how we feel after the nap, if we still want to carry through some of these ideas. Is folks, don't ever give up on the hope that things can and will get better than this point in time.
And for people that are listening to our podcast or watching it, who are contemplating making a change, deciding to, you know, let go of the way they're doing things, if they're sick and tired of being sick and tired, as we say, you've talked about going to treatment as interrupting the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Talk a little bit about the components of what one learns when they decide to interrupt the bottom. What are the things that have to be a part of one's recovery?
Yeah. You know, so some of that is based off, you know, in the rooms we talk about alcoholic addicts has got to hit their bottom. They've got to truly be able to surrender to move forward. Well, and a lot of times people get intervened on. They enter treatment before that bottom. And believe me, that's an okay thing because some people's bottom is death. A lot harder to recover once you're dead. Okay.
That's a very fair point.
That's a fair point. I think the data will support that. So, you know, whatever tool, whatever works, use it. And so what we're trying to do with treatment is really to help individuals say there's more yets. And as bad as this is, it can get worse. I remember when I was at the shelter in Chicago, though, it was a little easier. Coming into treatment at a place like Hazel and Betty Ford and Karen, it's a little different. When I was at the shelter, I didn't have to worry about step one. I'm like, if you don't think you're powerless, you're not going to believe me. Go back in the alley for another couple of nights and then come back. If the street hasn't taught you you're powerless, go get some more. But when you come in here, you know, I was a young kid. I wasn't in recovery. What could I tell you about why you need to stop using drugs? If the fact that you're literally walking in the back alley, selling your body, lost your kids, don't have a job, and that's what life is, if that's not the embodiment of powerlessness, there's nothing I can tell you that is. What I can tell you is recovery works. Because again, as I said, yesterday you were in the alley, today you're in the bed. So let's talk about steps 2 and 3 and where we can go from there. So I got the joy of working on the hope side of recovery. It was actually hard for me on the step one side to help people rip open, especially because denial, minimization, justification are such a big part of why people don't want to go into treatment. You know, oh, I'm not that bad. It's okay. They don't always see the wreckage of their life, or they stick to the one thing that's still there. I still have my job, or I still have my house. I still have this relationship, but everything else is in shambles. It's hard work helping pull back the layers to help people see that powerlessness if they're not there. And that's what treatment helps to do, is to help people see this is the reality of your life. A lot of times what you'll see in treatment is impact letters. That's not to beat people up. That's to help open eyes. That's to help beginning with honesty. We talk about the how of this program: honest, open, and willing. Here, let's have you hear about your life through somebody else's eyes. And you know what? Let's grab on to the gratitude that they care about and love about you enough that they don't want to see you hit bottom. They believe you've hurt enough. They don't want to see this going. But I will say one thing here. It doesn't have to be, I tried it and it didn't work. As long as you're still breathing, there's a chance for recovery. You don't have to worry about, I didn't make it through this treatment program, or I dropped out of this one, or I kept using here. As long as you still have a breath, you have a chance to make that pivot. Doesn't matter what you've done before. And that brings me into one thing. I'm sorry, I'm going to go off on a tangent here. The Serenity Prayer. I think the Serenity Prayer is one of the most powerful prayers, sayings, beings in the entire world. It's one of the best ones. And it's so simple. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. All right. One of those things is the past. A minute ago, all the way 54 years ago, I can't change any of that. Yet I see people live their lives backwards, doing things today to try to change yesterday. Use the Serenity Prayer. I can't change yesterday. The courage to change the things I can. That's this moment. The way it works is I don't do things today to fix yesterday. I do things today to fix tomorrow. And the wisdom to know the difference between what I can change and what I can't change. One of the things I see in treatment so often is people come in to fix yesterday. And it's when we can finally get them to see what I'm doing today fixes tomorrow is the big piece. And that to me is why, and we said it in every group at the shelter. I grew up in the rooms. We say it so much in treatment programmings. I actually had the ability to actually go back to my local high school, graduated with a class of 32. And my niece.
1932?
No, 19, not 1932. 32 class members. I got to go back when my niece graduated from high school and give the commencement address. And I had 5 minutes. They're like, 5 minutes, John, off the stage. You got to be done. I gave it on the Serenity Prayer as my life lesson to those students going out. I said, the biggest thing I can teach you is don't live your life backwards. Live it forwards. And here's a simple
guide. Love that. That's great. So I've heard you talk about the components of recovery, the things that lead towards recovery. an enhanced likelihood of success. One of the things you talk about, it's important, is the length of stay in a treatment facility. Another one is the connection to a therapeutic component. And that's the last one I want you to talk about a little bit, which is self-efficacy. I think the pet chapter 5 of the big book talks about the capacity to be honest with oneself. I just want to hear you talk about that a little bit, if sure. you don't mind.
Sure. And those three things aren't original to me. That's actually what the research and data showed, is that the best predictors of positive outcomes are those three items: length of engagement, therapeutic alliance, and self-efficacy. The first two are external characteristics. The third one, self-efficacy, is an internal characteristic. Self-efficacy is basically the belief that you can accomplish something. You can do something. In the 12 steps, I call it step 2. All right, we came to believe that I can do this, that my life can be restored to sanity. And so self-efficacy is that one thing that you do have control over. And going back to why I got into this field in the beginning, there again, I was able to push people's buttons. I could be, at the time, a little bit of an asshole at times. I knew how to see that little button inside and poke it. And that's where I decided I could use that skill for evil and bad will, or I could use that for good. And people there get confused on that too. They blame outside things. I'm mad because you did this, because you did that, or because this happened to me in my life, or because whatever happened. No, actually, the feelings are what you're responsible for. Actions of others, you're not responsible for those things. How you respond, how you react to it, that's something that you have control over and you have the ability to go through. So don't give up that power to somebody else. And so self-efficacy is such a core driving force inside individuals. That hope that I can actually get through it. And we talk about those darkest moments. We talk about the bottoms. We talk about how could this possibly be happening now. It's that belief that some way, something can make it better, can get you through anything. And that's where I talk about gratitude being one of those most powerful things. Because the one thing I learned from these women in the inner city who had a lot going against them, bad neighborhoods, bad education, gangs, drugs, violence, poverty, racism, going against them, were able to find a way out of this. That's the self-efficacy. That is the step 2. It's the miracle of the program. It's the base, the spiritual base that I can make this. And gratitude helps build it. If you can be grateful every single day, no matter what your situation is. And if I can find women sitting in the basement of a homeless shelter, living the life that they're living, say, I am grateful for this today, anybody can find gratitude. It's such a powerful emotion.
And one of the things that I think enhances the likelihood of one being able to have the characteristics you're talking about of self-efficacy is when we go to connect with other people in recovery, when we see that he did it and she did it, and it is possible, and maybe their bottom was higher, maybe their bottom was lower. It doesn't really matter to compare that, but they're doing it. So if they can do it, I can do it. That's why it's such magic that happens when we connect with one another. And it's not just in recovery, when we connect in one another in church, when we connect with one another in a business conference, when we connect with one another doing anything, it enhances our spirit. But when it comes to recovery and 12-step meetings, to see that the people that are around here start calling out those number of years that somebody's sober, that's not for that person. That's for the person that's hearing that they did it, so that they know it's possible that they can do it. You know, step 2.
Well, you know, too, and that's why we also count days. It's just for today. Is that today I am sober. And I can say I was sober for X number of days, X number of years. But at the end of the day, we're going to celebrate today. That's that keeping it simple. That's that keeping it real.
That's right. Today.
Is that it's a one day at a time program. And part of the anonymity of the program is, doesn't matter what my past was. It's, am I working the program today? Am I doing what I need to do today to keep myself sober, to share my story, to be of asset to somebody else that's out there? That's some of those key pieces that really makes life worth living. And for me, I get filled with that indescribable joy of being able to help people. And I can't think of a better way than going through life than having the jobs that I've had. I get to be a part of somebody's miracle, like every single day.
Mr. Driscoll, you are the light.
So I've got a chapter about the light. You mentioned one of the other authors that talk about it. I am not the light. I am using the light. I am a conduit.
Yes, that's what lesson 61 is.
Of the light.
It's exactly what it is.
I didn't create it. It's not mine. I get to be able
that's
to
right.
use it. And it's just like a candle. My one little light, I got to protect it in the wind, make sure it doesn't go out. But it's dim, especially in a dark room. But if I can share that light with the person next to me, and the person next to me, and the person next to me, suddenly that same little flame is suddenly now all lit up and we can all see. And that's the power. We talk about you got to give it away in order to keep it. Me giving you my light, a light, doesn't mean I don't have mine. I'm sharing it. Just like the, think about that candle. When it goes to the other person's flame, I'm not losing that flame. I'm giving it away in order to keep it. Such profound messages in that. And when we talk about the higher power, that's what we're talking about. I'm not the higher power, but I'm tapping into that spiritualness to be able to use that power. It's not my light. I use the example of the power company, actually, is one of the things I use. Is we trick ourselves thinking it's our power because we're the ones flipping on and off the light switch. Look, I got the power, turn it on. I don't have the power, turn it off. Turns out we don't have the power. If we don't have daily communication or monthly communication with the higher power, which is the power company, and sending them our check, they cut off the power, and suddenly me flipping the light switch doesn't do anything. I got to remember I'm a conduit of the power, and what I'm trying to do is connect to that higher power and allow that through me to help others.
That's beautiful. So before we wrap, I want you, you're now in a position where you had started a consulting business, and then somehow the world decided that you weren't going to be in a consulting position, and you're heading up the Caron Treatment Center. What are some of the things, some of the visions, some of the expectations or even dreams that you have for Caron Foundation and Caron Treatment Center?
Boy, we got another couple hours, huh, to go on the podcast. So I've got lots of them. And again, this is one of these more be revealed. I wasn't planning to become the CEO of Caron Treatment Centers. This isn't what I was doing. I was a consultant. I was helping my friend Brad Sordi do it. This was completely unexpected. And now that I got here and I'm the CEO of Caron Treatment Centers, one of the most respected treatment centers, one of the longest tenure, I never had the opportunity to meet Dick and Catherine Caron, but I know as children and learned about what they embodied. And it's something I can get behind. When you hear the story of Dick and Catherine and what they did and why they did it, it's like, oh yeah, I can be a part of this. This is absolutely amazing. So part of me here is I'm the baton passer. I took the baton from a wonderful group of folks. My job is to carry the baton and pass it on to the next because, you know, you mentioned earlier, think about the ripple effect of what I've been able to do. Think about the ripple effect of what Dick and Catherine Caron have been able to do. It's absolutely amazing. And I am totally honored to be in a spot that I can help carry on their legacy and what they've been able to do. And I get to play a little piece of that. So a couple of big things that I'm looking at in this role, in this position as part of the National Association. There's a piece in there that says, you know what? What do I need to do to help make Caron the best treatment center we can? But even if we are the best treatment center, we can't be enough. There's 54 million Americans that suffered from this disease that we now call substance use disorder in the last 12 months. As big as Karen could possibly get, we can't treat 54 million. My mission not only is to help Karen be successful, but my ultimate goal is to not see people suffer from a treatable disease. And the number one competition I have out there is not another treatment center. The number one competition I have is people don't think of this as a disease. It's stigma. It's people thinking, I should be able to deal with this myself. And the suffering continues and the deaths continue because people don't want to reach out for help. Denial, minimization happen. You don't see this with other healthcare. One of the things we've known for years, almost my entire career, this is a brain disease. All the articles, all the research. Yet our field does very little to treat this as a brain disease. What other disease of an organ do we not medically treat the organ? Heart disease does it. Lung disease does it. Kidney disease does it. Everybody's focusing on the organ. We understand what's happening, what's measurement with it, what the treatment does. Yet when it comes to addiction and mental health, very little is actually done to assess the brain electricity, the brain chemicals, the brain structural function. And why not? One of the things that we've been able to learn in the technology, and one of the things I'm so glad we won the battle of parity, the Affordable Care Act of being an essential benefit, the Surgeon General of 2018's comprehensive report on addiction and treatment, and that treatment works and recovery is possible, and this is a brain disease, is that it allows us to be a part of the medical community and medical advances happen. I don't want the same heart care that my dad got 50 years ago. I want the new heart care. My dad died because we didn't have stents and we didn't have medications at the time to be able to treat it. Today, had my dad have the same heart attack, the paramedics on the ambulance in this rural community would have had the medication and the mid-level technician would have had the technology to save his life and he wouldn't have died at 55. Yet addiction and mental health continue under the stigma to not receive the research, the funding, and the care of the brain that we need. Yet it doesn't mean it's not happening. Our brethren, when it comes to Alzheimer's, dementia research, traumatic brain injury, trauma, what's occurring in the brain is being studied. The technology is out there. What our field needs to do is begin to use that. Not as a solution. Hopefully you've just heard me talk all about the spiritual solution of that. I am not throwing that out. That is a key part, but it's understanding that that treatment affects our brain. And when we can measure the brain and improve it and watch what's happening, it improves outcomes. It reduces stigma. Today, if I show up with blurry eyesight, the organ of the eyes, I do not look myself in the mirror and say, not today, not another day. Today, I'm going to see in focus. I don't do that. I go and I see an ophthalmologist. I go and get my eyes tested and measured. And I use treatment. Sometimes daily treatment. Here's some glasses. They'll help you see. I got to do these every day? I got to wear this every minute? No, I wear them. Right?
Now, there's research being done at Karen.
There's lots of research being done at Karen, and we're focusing on the brain because that's where the solutions lie to help people get better. And if we're going to help 54 million Americans, what I need to do is move away from the stigma that this is a personal weakness or a moral failing and get it into this is a brain disease like other diseases. You need treatment. You deserve treatment. Stop trying to say, I can see in focus and get the help you need. So my number one goal here on focusing on the brain is to get the stigma of addiction away. Betty Ford did this with breast cancer. Today, it's all out there. Back in the 70s, even before Susan G. Komen, Mrs. Ford, as the president of the United States, she had breast cancer. She's a survivor of that. She put a name on it. It used to be shunned. You couldn't use the word breast. You couldn't talk about these things. Today it's out there. People are getting screened. People have medicine. People have treatment for it. It's not a shameful thing. We need to do that with addiction and mental health. It's 50 years too late.
With that said, from my own personal experience, and you talked about Dick Caron, in 1982, I was a first-year lawyer, and I went to a rehab. Had I said that I was in recovery in 1982, I would have had no clients as a young attorney. Today, while the stigma still exists, I'm not minimizing the importance of it. The difference between the attitude of the world around us and someone who's in recovery has improved over the years, but it hasn't improved to the point that it's going to, it needs to be at, so that it's equivalent to those other diseases. But it is, it's a glacial pace, admittedly, but there has been changes, and changes in other areas of our society have changed. It's not just breast cancer. I mean, you know, gender bias. I mean, all the different things. But it almost is like, to me, it goes like this. You know, it's not a straight line to success. And there's no doubt that people look at the disease of substance use disorder as a weakness. And it's still there, and we haven't gotten there. But, you know, with efforts that you're making and efforts that are being made all around the world, you know, hopefully we'll move it a little quicker, because 40-something years is not, you know, not exactly the kind of progress you make with some of these other technologies for other diseases.
Right. So what can I do as the CEO of Caron Treatment Centers? I have access to resources. I have access to podcasts. People want to talk to me and hear my opinion. I want to be a force for good, not just for the individuals and families that Caron treats. They are very important to me. But to all those individuals that suffer from this disease, because I know what the hell of addiction looks like. But I also know what the heaven and beauty of recovery looks like, and everybody deserves a chance at it. And to let stigma get in the way is something that I'm going to do my best with the power and the influence that I have to try to make sure that as many people as possible, as many families as possible, have the opportunity to access good, reliable, effective treatment.
Well, speaking as someone in recovery, someone who's also an alum of the Caron Treatment Center, I am very grateful for the work you're doing and the impact that you've made. I'm also very grateful for your having appeared on our podcast on Crosstalk. And this has been a terrific session. And I've gotten a lot of inspiration, and you're even moving me further in the direction to follow the light and to try to be a carrier of the light. I think that's a good bow on our session. And I hope all of our listeners have enjoyed our podcast today. Thank you for watching, and thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.